Okay, well, good morning, everybody. I'm going to be talking this morning about. So we decided, by the way, to, in case you're expecting Gavier first, we decided to swap the order because it's a slightly more logical way of presenting today's material. What I'm going to be talking about is.
What time did you decide to allocate yourself?
I decided to allocate about half an hour, the usual amount.
I hope you're going to be strict.
Well, I'm sure Robin will be. We'll be wrapping across the knuckles if I go over my limit. So what I want to talk about really was some work that's been going on since ultimately the early 1990s, when I was a research fellow back in the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge. We were looking at what we thought was probably one of the simplest possible sort of model system, if you like, for a granular gas. This consists of essentially a bucket of one or a few monolayers of spherical particles being bounced around rather violently, excited by a sinusoidal waveform, peak acceleration many times or several times the acceleration due to gravity. And so this early work was done with high-speed photography. Steve Waugh, some of you may remember Steve Waugh, who did a lot of the early work. In the sort of mid to late 90s, we started moving away from the two-dimensional geometry. We kept getting sort of the issue. So the two-dimensional geometry is where you have two side walls with just a single layer of grains which are rattling around between them. And there's always the issue of, you know, what effect does the side walls have on the motion of the particles. So in the mid-90s or mid to late 90s, we started looking at positron emission as a technique for looking within truly three-dimensional geometry. So this is really is a bucket as opposed to a sort of a two-dimensional bucket, full three-dimensional bucket. The drawback being you can only label a single particle. So what I want to do, when I gave my very brief sort of talk last week, it's clear that quite a few people were not aware of the positron technique. So I'd just like to introduce that briefly in a couple of slides. Before going on to some work which is not yet been published, it's about to appear, the one-dimensional hydrodynamic model. So this is where we're trying to model the temperature and packing fraction distributions within this bucket. And to do this, we were looking at least a couple of the heat flux models and a couple of the boundary conditions that are being suggested in the literature. Now, this is still rather an idealized model for the real system. So we've been looking at also at a couple of the ways in which one could try and model it more realistically. One is looking at the sort of the full three-dimensional aspects within our model. So we've been looking at an axisymmetric hydrodynamic model implemented using finite element analysis. That work is still ongoing, but I wanted to show you some of the results which are coming out. And then the other aspects which we tend to ignore with a positron emission particle tracking is the sort of the time variation. So we're assuming that we have a steady state, that the frequency of vibration is high enough that we have a steady state within our bucket. But we're looking at this, is this a reasonable assumption or not in the topic four here, where we've been looking using another technique, NMR, magnetic resonance, where we're actually getting phase resolved velocity measurements within the three-dimensional bed. Once again, that has not been published yet. So just to acknowledge the various contributions. So in the group, Tom Martin is a postdoc, Harish is a PhD student. Ricky was instrumental in starting out the positron work. He's a senior lecturer now at Loughborough and will be here next week again. David Parker runs the facility, the positron emission particle tracking facility at Birmingham. Mick Mantle and Andy Sederman run the corresponding facility, the NMR facility at Cambridge that we've been using. And then Jim and Mark Shattuck, we've been interacting with since the Cambridge equivalent of this program, which ran about 18 months ago. Jim with the helping us understand his kinetic theory, and Mark, who came across from City College to help with the NMR experiments and funding from the usual sources in the UK. So this then is the geometry I've been explaining in words. We have our bucket with the few particles inside, standing on some sort of glorified huge loudspeaker, about a kilowatt or so. And we label one of the particles, and we label it radioactively, or David labels it radioactively. And so over the course of a few hours, this then emits positrons. These then annihilate with a local electron. You get a pair of gamma rays, back-to-back gamma rays, which So travel in opposite directions like this, and they then pass through these detector plates, and these detector plates measure where these gamma rays pass through them and the times that they occur. So you can sort of, by matching the time stamps, if you like, you can work out which correspond to which, if this, which is the partner or the twin ray for say this one and for this one and so on. And by triangulation, you can then work out where the particle was when it was giving out that bunch of gamma rays at that time. Okay, so it's, so say David Parker runs the facility. I think really our contribution was to recognise that it had been around since the early 90s, this technique, but we were recognising that the time resolution that was available was sufficiently good to actually resolve the motion between the collisions. So this allowed you to look at the sort of collision regime and get quantities out which hadn't really been done before.
So just, what is your spatial and temporal resolution?
Okay, so the spatial resolution, there's a trade-off between the two, of course, but typically with the system we have at the moment, we're in the temporal resolution 1 to 2 milliseconds. Measurement accuracy is only of the order of 1 to 2 millimeters at that sort of time resolution. So it's not terribly good spatial resolution. On the other hand, you can leave it running for many hours and average out statistical fluctuation. Can you focus it? It doesn't work like a conventional. Okay, so the gamma rays, I'm not quite sure what sort of lenses you'd use for those, but no, you just, it's sort of line of flight.
And what are the size of the particle?
Well, we typically use 4 or 5 millimeter diameter. Typically it would be some material like glass, and you can use smaller ones, but then you get fewer positrons, so the signal to noise ratio goes down. So what I'll just show is sort of an example of the XYZ coordinates for one particle in a very dilute bed. So here, this is X, this is Y. So you see the Y, the vertical, you see the sort of parabolic and then trajectory, and then it's hitting another particle and colliding and so on. This is about 1 second's worth of data, and you get, you know, many hours worth of that sort of data. So
where is the
plastic
jumping before colliding with another particle?
Yeah, there are a few particles here, and this is pretty dilute, so you can see it's undergoing a whole trajectory before it's, you know, a whole sort of parabolic trajectory before colliding.
What do you mean, a few particles there? So we're not watching one particle?
There are a few particles, but we're looking at one. We're always looking at one, but we see that there must have been another particle there which is invisible to us because it's suddenly changed, suddenly. Yeah, suddenly deviate.
This continuity in X at the earlier
here
is not exactly.
Well, that's
XYZ.
Well, that's could be because it's colliding with a boundary, a vertical boundary, so it hits, so it changes its X position, its X velocity, but it doesn't change the Y velocity, for example.
So, do you have only one positron active particle?
Yes, one positron.
Simultaneously, few.
Well, they are working on that to measure rotation. If you want to measure rotation, you need three sources, and they are working on that. But the problem is the time resolution tends to go down as soon as you do that. Okay. So that is the sort of the raw data, if you like, as it comes to us. Now, in order to... Yeah, good. So what we're interested in is information such as granular temperature, such as packing fraction profiles. And the granular temperature we measure by calculating the mean square displacement for a particle. So you divide the cell up into little volume elements, and you then calculate for each time the particle enters that a given volume element, you then track its or calculate its position relative to that starting position as a function of time, and you bin the you average out over many of these events, and you end up with a mean square displacement versus time. This is 10 milliseconds, and you get this sort of quadratic toe in the mean square displacement before it goes over to more linear, sort of diffusive type behavior. And it's this, as long as you can resolve with time resolution comparable to or better than the mean free time, then you can actually extract the granular temperature from the sort of the form, this sort of approximate parabolic form down here. Okay, and this is just showing some of the results that we've had in the past, so 4 years ago, where we showed this is the axis here of the cell. You can measure, for example, by doing finite differencing, you can measure the flow field. In this case, we've seen sort of small convection rolls being set up. You can measure the packing fraction distribution simply by measuring how long, what fraction of the total time does a particle spend in a given volume element, and you end up with contours here of packing fraction distribution, where we're seeing a sort of an enhanced packing fraction or higher density near the wall. And you measure the temperature, and this is sort of pairs of curves from four different excitation levels. The open circles are taken from a central core region, and the filled circles are from the outer annulus. You're seeing that you're getting a lower temperature nearer the wall, and that's consistent with a higher density there. And in a sense, we've just got sort of buoyancy-driven convection rolls being set up.
John, just to be clear,
yeah.
Not that one version is right and one is wrong, but your definition of temperature includes or excludes the contribution from the mean flow field square?
In this particular case, we didn't subtract off the flow field, but when you work out the order of magnitude compared with the actual sort of contribution from this, sort of the rattling around, it's relatively small. So we, in this case, we haven't done that. In that paper we worked out, we sort of showed the order of magnitude, and it's not really that important for that. Yeah. So I showed this last week, and I'm not going to dwell on it again, but just so you can see the sort of terminology we're using here. This is the 1D model to try and understand the sort of packing fraction distributions and temperature distributions that we get within the bed. And we're trying to do this. Previous workers have looked at this, but have tended to be treating the sort of the energy going in from the base as something which they can't calculate from first principles, and they just sort of fit to a molecular dynamics code, for example. What we've been trying to do is actually look at it sort of almost from first principles and try and work out, without any adjustable parameters, what should the temperature distribution, packing fraction distribution be in this bed. So we're taking a 1D model to start with, and we have various equations such as the force balance. So if you take a small cube of material in the bed, the pressure changes in the vertical direction as you go across from the bottom surface to the top. That changes due to the mass of the material in there. And that can be expressed in differential form like that. The PdZ is minus rho g. Rho is the density, g is the acceleration due to gravity. You have the equation of states. E is the packing fraction, d is the diameter, p is the pressure, t is the temperature. And this is a sort of a high density form of the ideal gas equation of state. And we have the energy flux. So T is our granular temperature. It's not a thermodynamic temperature, of course. So it's a measure of how the velocity fluctuations, how quickly the grains are rattling around. And so this is then the equivalent heat flux, heat in inverted commas. And there are various models around for describing what these transport coefficients, kappa and mu, should be. And then you have also the energy dissipation equation. So this is saying that if you have the same volume element again, the energy going in from the bottom is not the same as that coming out through the top because of dissipation. And this can be expressed in this differential form like this. So you have to take account in the 1D model not only of the grain-grain dissipation, but also if you take a thin slice, you've got to also think about the dissipation against the walls. And that's taken into account of with that term there.
And once again, the mean flow is being dropped.
Oh, yes, we're forgetting about mean flow. Yeah, completely. Okay, so what we're comparing is a couple of the models, and I described this one last week, so I'm going to this again. Basically, it's just the conductivity is some function of restitution coefficient times the thermodynamic corresponding quantity you expect for a thermal fluid. And then you have this extra term, this mu term, which is in front of this dE to by dz, which is not present for a thermal fluid. So if this this quantity here goes to zero as e, the restitution coefficient, goes to one. The other expression we looked at is Jim Jenkins' model. So this is now applicable to high density. You have these extra terms in here, which if you just take this one here, this is the low density limit, you just have this term here. And in the low density limits, you end up with the equivalent kappa boils down to the same thing as that. So the two are sort of agree there, but you just have this, there are sort of different assumptions made in deriving these. So we thought it'd be interesting to compare how these two behave when you put these two different coefficients into the model. Now the boundary conditions, you need to know if you want to do the 1D model, these equations, this one and this one, gives you a second order equation. These two give you a first order equation. So you end up with three first order ODEs. So you need three boundary conditions. I discussed the one of these last week, which is that the flux goes to zero, the heat flux as z goes to infinity. What you'd really like, though, the easiest way of solving these equations is to, if you were to know what the packing fraction, temperature, and gradient were at z equals zero, and but you don't know all those quantities. So we know that this is true, and we also know that we have a certain number of grains. So therefore, the integral of eta, average integrated up through the bed, should be proportional to the number of grains in the bed. So these are two conditions you can make use of. But the third one, you need to incorporate the model for how energy is transferred from the base. And we've looked at a couple of models from the literature. One is by Richman. He considered a base which has bumpy boundaries, vibrating in all three perpendicular directions with an equal RMS value, going random motion. And he then works out what the flux is, the heat flux. And it's an approximation. And it's proportion. The flux basically is proportional to this quantity I've called IE star. Star means non-dimensional. And here, this is the temperature of the gas above the base. This is then calculated for various RMS base velocities. So you find that if you have a relatively hot gas above a base that's moving pretty quickly, then you're getting quite a lot of energy transfer. On the other hand, if you've got a hot gas above a relatively low level of excitation base, then it will actually be taking energy out of the granular gas. Okay, so that's one model. Another one, which was Steve Waugh and I came up with 10 years ago now, looking at the sort of detailed mechanics of the interaction with the base. So we're plotting here, this is for a triangular waveform now, it's not a random one. You have a triangular waveform. This is the time, this is the height versus time for the base and for the interacting particles. And so you can divide the incoming particles into various velocity ranges, and for the low speed ones only collide with the base going up, so they always gain energy. Sometimes if they're going a bit faster, they can collide with the base going down, so they tend to lose a bit of energy, lose energy then. You can work out probabilities for each of these possibilities. You can get double bounces as well. You work out the probabilities, integrate over a Maxwellian distribution, and lo and behold, you get this corresponding quantity here, or function IE star, which when you sort of switch back to the Richman, you know, considering they're sort of derived in two different ways, not bad agreement.
So
I was quite.
What was the basis for his derivation?
Well, his derivation. He basically satisfied momentum and satisfied. He basically calculated the. Did a sort of standard kinetic theory approach for calculating the number of particles within a certain speed range, a certain angle range, integrated up. He ended up with an integral, which he then approximated as a series expansion, and then this is the lowest order term that I showed. I mean, a bit difficult to explain in...
Where does the coefficient of restitution come into this?
Coefficient of restitution... It's in the epsilons here.
This curve on the left is for one particular coefficient restitution?
It's for one particular coefficient restitution, yeah, that's right. We've evaluated that for the same value of restitution coefficient that occurs in the Richman.
Which was?
0.91 or something like that. Yeah. is for our experiments, for those experiments, epsilon was 0.91. Okay, so we end up with this is temperature and packing fraction for three different excitation levels. This is for the Bray model. No, not bad agreements apart from this sort of linear ramp up here, and we've discussed that at last week's lecture. I'm not going to go into that again. This is using the Jenkins constitutive equations, and possibly, you know, which is better? It's very difficult to say. I mean, they're both pretty. The thing that strikes me really is considering there's no adjustable parameters, we're neglecting all sorts of things here: friction, the convection currents, the fact that it's really a three-dimensional cell, the fact that it's just time-varying. So, you know, to my mind, the thing that strikes me is how good the agreement is there. So, what I want to do now is just to show you the attempts to look at the sort of these additional aspects, or a couple of the additional aspects, one of starting off with the fact that really we have a three-dimensional geometry here. So the approach we've taken now is to solve this as an axis-symmetric problem. We have the central axis of the cell here, we have the grains wrapping around, we have the various boundaries to consider, and we're now solving using a finite element method. We started off using the PD solver in MATLAB. It wasn't really sufficiently general to allow us to do this, so we bought FEMLAB, and we implemented the various boundary conditions which are shown here, not to go through them in detail. And
Just go back a slide.
Yeah.
Is the temperature, so the flux equation is working well at the base, or it's not working well? The slope at the bottom.
The gradient, well, it's not bad. It's difficult to set. I mean, you know, there's certain error bars on these points just down here. But
again, one back.
Okay.
No, it's not a question of better job. I mean, beyond about 15 centimeters, not really interesting.
So the temperature profile is pretty flat. Did you comment on that?
Why is it
so flat, by and large?
Why it's so flat high up, you mean? In this, you mean?
Yeah.
Well,
it's pretty.
Yeah, because there are not many particles. That once the density goes down, then the dissipation rate is going down. So the temperature is not decaying with height.
And is the what's the mean for
that? Well, I'm not sure what the mean free time is typically a few milliseconds, and that the, you know, the, well, it's going to be, you know, the order of a 1 or 2 grain diameters at the higher density.
Going to a lot of collisions, is that right?
Near the base they are, but then as you look higher and higher, then you enter the Knudsen regime, which is when the point at which you then you need to, you know, it no longer works. That's the reason for these rather non-physical profiles. They don't work above a certain height because the hydrodynamics doesn't apply in that high altitude region.
So the Knudsen regime starts above 15 or something like that?
Yeah, depending on what your criterion is for the Knudsen regime. Okay. So I just want to quickly show these what I'm showing here are So it's one particular excitation level, it is temperature, packing fraction, experimental in the middle, as you see by the high noise level. This is the Jenkins and the Bray constitutive equations. And what you find, I mean, looking at the packing fraction, there's not a huge difference between them. I think sort of the common feature really is that there's experimentally we see a bigger sort of variation across the radius than we do in the model.
So why would you expect these predictions to differ?
Which predictions?
The Jenkins and Bray.
Because you don't have a your mu term is zero, and
so that's the reason. Is that
that's the reason you have high density correction terms.
Okay.
Javier's doesn't. Although Jim's given me a paper which some formula where I can include those high density terms also within his theory. So.
But I think also the density is relatively low, so there's reason to expect it to look similar.
Yes, that's right.
And the restitution coefficient is relatively high.
Yes, so that's right as well. Yes, yeah. Okay. And then another excitation. I don't want to dwell on these, but you see there's a higher sort of effect of the wall than in the predicted by the models. And once again, we see an increase in temperature in the Bray model, which it's difficult. It's not really seen there in the experimental result. For this is one monolayer, I should say. When you have more monolayers, then you start to see the increase occasionally. So just keeping an eye on the clock. The other aspect is this sort of the steady state assumption, and what we've been doing is now using NMR to look at velocity distributions and phase resolve velocity distributions. So we're looking at whether this is a reasonable assumption or not. So this is the NMR spectrometer. As Martin mentioned, you have to be quite careful about bringing anything sort of, you know, like a motor nearby. So this is our motor. With a drive shaft and then a glass rod. So as you get very close, you can't even have anything metallic nearby. So we need a glass rod to drive the whole thing. So a little cell inside there, about 20 millimeters across, containing mustard seeds, which are then being rattled around frequencies, typically 30 to 40 hertz was the highest we could achieve with this particular rig. Okay, and what we get out is velocity distributions in the Z direction. So what we're doing here is we're actually integrating through the thickness, so we're getting the average distribution, velocity distribution, at a whole series of slices at different Z values, and we're getting the probability for PZ as a function of Z. And we're getting it time resolve as well. So what I'm going to do now is just show you a couple of videos. This is shown, this is our Z coordinate, and this is our VZ coordinate. So if I were to take a slice through this image and sort of, you know, plot it as a graph, that would be telling me what is the distribution of particle speeds in the Z direction for that slice. It's a little bit, when you first see these movies, it's a bit difficult to understand what they mean, but that's basically what it means. This is the cell, which is, unfortunately, the material actually has quite a strong NMR signal. We weren't quite expecting that. But
what is the material? Oh, that's from the base.
It's this is the base here. We have a little glass slice as acting as the base, so there's much less signal coming from there, and then we have the signal from the side walls. Everything is, of course, the entire cell is moving up at the same velocity, so you end up with a line. In this case, it's at minus 0.3, so it's moving down at 0.3. Everything's moving down at 0.3 meters per second, and then this is the stuff in the middle. This is the signal from the seeds inside. Okay, so I'm just going to show you. So this is a monolayer. I'm showing just showing the movie four times. So this is the whole cell moving up and down, up and down. And this is the gas, the granular gas, which is as I say, we're measuring the velocity distribution in that direction. And what we're seeing is one of the things to be aware of is that we're seeing that the velocity of the gas inside is sort of less than the peak velocity of the cell. So really what's happening,
bouncing up and down, really coherent motion.
That's one of the other things. There's a lot of, so the particle speeds are relatively, they're lower than the base speed. I'm showing you a sort of triangular waveform, although we're trying to get a sinusoidal waveform. So basically the particles are all colliding at the end. These are then bouncing back into this sort of cloud. So you're getting sort of raining of these particles from this dark cloud, and then they're being injected back in here. If the effect is you can get bimodal velocity distributions at one point in the cycle. This is the sort of distribution you get. You get the distribution from the cloud and then the recently collided particles there as well. For the first half of the cycle, the grains can't catch up with the base. So in effect, this gas is expanding into a vacuum, and that has the consequence that you have a negative bias to the velocity distribution close to the base. Any particle you find close to the base has by definition not collided with the base, and it's therefore has a negative velocity. Okay, this is perhaps a bit more interesting. If we show a case where we have two layers, so we've got a stronger NMR signal here. And once again, definitely not a steady state distribution. The restitution coefficient about 0.7, so it's less elastic than many of the systems we've been looking at in the past. So the coherent motion would be expected to be more obvious here. Nevertheless. So what we can do is just plot, if we take now a slice at 8 millimetres, so we're now going to take a slice through that distribution and plot that now as a function of time throughout the cycles. This is what we see. You get quite significant variation through the cycle. This peak suddenly broadens and then gets narrower as the gas is cooling down. And this is a best fit Gaussian, so it's a pretty, the red line is a best fit Gaussian. So it's a pretty good, you know, to my eyes, it's a pretty good matchup to the. sometimes get asked, you know, do you have any sort of overpopulated tails here in the distribution? The signal to noise ratio really doesn't allow one to say yes or no. On the other hand, if you were to average the probability density function over a complete cycle and then fit the Gaussian, this is what you would get. You would see quite a skew in the distribution, so clearly a far more significant effect than the overpopulation of the tails in this case. And the other thing is that the average temperature you would estimate by doing that process is significantly higher than you get by averaging the temperatures throughout the cycle by fitting the Maxwellian to the time resolved probability density function. Okay, if we look at the granular temperature distribution, so this is now what I'm going to do is, so we're taking, you know, the width of that as the measure of how hot the gas is. And that's at one height. If I now do the same thing at a whole series of different heights throughout the cell and plot that now as a function of time, you see this wave, travelling through the heat, which corresponds, when you saw on the previous plot, you saw the sudden widening of the Gaussian, that corresponds to this compression wave heating up the gas as it's travelling up from the base. You can do the same trick and you can then say, well, okay, if I was just measuring an average temperature, this is what I guess, and possibly the hint of an upturn as well at the end. But that is masking out all these sort of huge sort of dynamic effects that are going on and the waves washing around. Surprisingly, perhaps, again, using the Jenkins and Richmond ODE, the 1D ODE solution, works pretty well, no fitting parameters or anything again here.
Can you see the dynamics of T versus
L? Yeah. This one here? That's four cycles, just replaying four times. That's
okay. Okay.
Yes. Next, it's the one after this. And this is the mean velocity distribution. So this is now the position of that Maxwellian as a function of time. Previous plot was the width of it, effectively, and this is now the position of it. So what we're seeing is near the base, the grains are moving down on the whole. Further up, they're moving up. So in effect, the whole bed is sort of dilating, if you like. But this has to, through the cycle, this has to average out to zero. So there has to be some compression going on, which we simply, I think we must be missing that. You know, it must be happening so quickly, we're just not resolving that.
Temperature subtracting the mean velocity of locally?
This is fitted to the Gaussian, so we are, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's the width of the Gaussian, whereas when you fit to the time average distribution, then you're not subtracting it. The graphs I'm showing, these are the ones which are fitted to the Gaussian, and this is the result, this is the width of the Gaussian effect.
No, but you subtract out the local average velocity or the average velocity integrated over the entire
subtracting out the velocity at that particular slice. So, okay, so it's what we're doing is we're fitting to each distribution at each time, at each z value, and it's the width of that is what we're plotting on the next graph. Okay, and then this is the last one. So this is the graph that's who's after this. So this is the packing fraction distribution. Not normalized, but you're not seeing huge sort of variation with time, so that's a bit less dramatic, and say, and then you can plot the time averaged here and the ODE. So a bit of a significant deviation close to the base, but considering it's time averaged, it's not doing too bad, badly. Okay, so just to summarize then, I've shown positron emission data, true dimensional data, and I've shown that by comparing it with 1D solutions solved by implementing a model solving a set of ODEs, both the Bray and the Jenkins Heaflux expression seem to give, well, to my mind, remarkably good agreement with the experiment. Both of them have slightly different detailed features, but in broad terms, they're both doing a pretty good job. But if you then look in a bit more closely, you find, well, the 3D results tend to suggest there's not a huge radio dependence. There's some radio dependence, but it's not that significant, although the model was not showing quite as much as we saw experimentally. And then the NMR technique we developed with the people at Cambridge provides phase resolve measurements of the probability for distribution for VZ as a function of Z, averaging through the thickness. And really, I think the message I've been trying to convey really is that the time average PDFs and the temperature distributions, they mask several interesting phenomena. And probably the next step we'd be thinking of going down now is actually looking at implementing a 1D dynamic model to try and understand these effects a bit better. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Were you limited by the driving frequency there? And why did you use such a low frequency?
Well, it's not such a low frequency. I mean, with the positron experiments with this massive rate 1 kilowatt thing, we typically work at 50 hertz. If you go too high, then you're limited by the peak acceleration that this thing can drive. So this little motor with a long drive shaft and so on, if you go too high frequency, that you start to excite resonances in the drive shaft, and it just becomes. I mean, alternative could be some sort of piezoelectric actuator or something like that.
Low relative to the diffusion while you're having this whole periodic structure.
Yes, it is. That's. No, it'd be nice to have, you know, a more ideal sort of experimental setup. Would be nice, something running to kilohertz or something like that.
What is your assessment of the experiments of the Candela group? Are they complementary to these because they're at a different density and restitution?
Well, I've read a couple of those papers. Okay. So, I think they're pretty on the 1D quasi-static model. They're pretty comparable in many ways. They've done NMR experiments as well, but I think so what they've drawn out of those experiments is, oh, it's pretty steady state, and you know, so they were matching up to 1D steady state model. But what strikes me from these results is that it's, you know, for these restitution coefficients, you need to include the dynamic effects, really.
It's going to be very complicated boundary conditions when you've got a combination of the mean flow.
Yeah, I guess so. Yes. Yeah. We'll be looking for some theoreticians who can help us out there. So I guess Jim, anybody interested in working on these lines would be pleased to hear from you. Yeah. Martin had a.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit quite different question. I mean, I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit why your NMR technique, where you actually get quite a lot of information. It's very different from MRI, which is, you know, orders of magnitude slower. So what is the trick there to get the density in the
bottom? Well, it's you're not imaging in a conventional sense. So we're averaging through the thickness in this through the x and y collapsing onto a line. So you're not getting distributions. So we're sacrificing two spatial axes
right.
to get much higher time resolution and trading also to get velocity distributions as opposed to spatial information. So
right.
so you make.
But so it is actually quite similar to MRI, but the trick is basically average and
there's the tricks are exactly the same as in conventional MRI. I mean, we're working with people at a hospital where we're measuring blood flow within the aorta and looking at sort of effects of plaques in the vessel and so on. And using pretty much similar sort of concepts, although this is a rather novel technique that they developed when working with us. But the same basic concept of measure of getting velocity information is a standard technique in MRI.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks very much.